Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Mario Utreras. I represent Plaintiff Appellant Milam and the five other plaintiff appellants in this case. I'd respectfully request to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. This case was decided on the eve of a jury trial in the defendant's favor on a motion to dismiss after they had received a favorable ruling on motions in limine barring the plaintiffs from seeking back pay damages. There are four reasons why the district court erred in dismissing this case and should have allowed the plaintiffs to proceed to jury trial on their claims.
Could I just quick ask you a fast question, Mr. Utreras? Were all the produce clerks during the relevant time period African American?
All the produce clerks that were part-time, save for the two favorably treated individuals and and one who was part of this litigation, but which the court ultimately dismissed out on summary judgment. That person was, I believe, Hispanic or non-African American, but it was the six plaintiff African Americans and then the two Caucasian females.
Thank you.
First, Your Honor, the district court erred in construing the fact that they were unable to specify the amount.
Well, how many what damages are you seeking?
Well, the damages that we were seeking were.
I want a number.
Your Honor, the number is very difficult to calculate.
What is your number?
The number would probably be about $87,000 in this case, and we calculated that figure based on a determination of the minimum hours that the favorite employee received versus what the plaintiffs could have received and recognized that they could not all receive duplicative time or hours for that amount of money. And we calculated that time out to the periods.
That's a huge amount of money for just claiming some additional hours. How did you calculate that amount?
Well, Your Honor, what we did is, and of course, obviously, we never got this opportunity to do it at the district court, even though we had sought that.
I understand you. You can't have a jury. You can't have a trial without having some damages calculation going in. I mean, sometimes you can leave, punitive damages to the jury's imagination or something like that. But if you're seeking compensatory damage, you have to be prepared to give them some kind of damage theory that a judge will, uphold as not unduly speculative, right?
I understand that, Your Honor. And we weren't contending. Well, it's our position that these were not unduly speculative. On the other hand, they were not definitive. They fell within this area of probabilities based.
They don't have to be definitive. There's nothing wrong with probabilistic damages. But the puzzle from the briefs is what exactly were you going to give the juror as, like saying, well, there were 1,000 hours here that these guys, that your clients could have claimed, and we think they would have claimed, between 400 and 600, something like that. But I don't see any, in the briefs, I don't see any discussion of how you were proposing to at least narrow the area of uncertainty.
Well, Your Honors, in our motion to reconsider, we had proffered to the court that what we wished to do was to resubmit a calculation, and that what we would do is we would go through it with all of the plaintiffs and basically have them go through day by day which days they would have had to claim hours. This is
That should have been done at the outset. And
did you depose each of the plaintiffs to ascertain which weeks they claimed, another employee's hours, which week they worked?
Well,
the maximum number of hours allowed under the collective bargaining agreement, did you do that?
Well, Your Honor, I mean, the plaintiffs were deposed, but they were not asked specific questions as to here's this week or which day would you have claimed. They were asked general questions as to, tell me which day you would have claimed in a general context.
Is there some reason you couldn't have ascertained some of the specifics during discovery?
Your Honor, it's a complicated formula simply because it involves a lot of subjective factors, such as a plaintiff's respective schedules for six people on any given day going back a number of years for a period of X number of years, and therefore it did not lend itself to a simple formula, but rather...
That's how most cases are. I mean, it's almost always somewhat complicated, isn't it?
Well, Your Honor, I would submit that even if, you know, we couldn't do that, we had an admission by the defendants that there was at least something more than a de minimis value to these damages, and that even if we couldn't demonstrate with any degree of specificity the amount of damages
now
that they could seek as back
pay. How are you going to get up to the $87,000 figure? I don't understand. What were these? Were your clients going to testify that, you know, a year ago on December 1st, you know, I was looking for more hours, but there was Miss Villanueva, and she was doing produce stuff, so I figured they were full and didn't need my time, or what? I don't know.
That's exactly what we would have had to do. That's
I don't remember any of that. That's
well,
not realistic.
But then that should not certainly
it should
be something to the detriment of...
There can be injury, but just no way to calculate damages because people don't remember these things. Then you're just out of luck.
Well, Your Honor, we would submit that, for example, if there were morning shifts, which one of these...
No one knows how much time Villanueva was spending as a produce clerk, right? So if nobody knows how much time she was spending, how on earth will they figure out how many hours of hers they could have claimed? And anyway, she wasn't listed as a produce clerk. So just explain, how could Villanueva's misclassification have affected your clients?
Well, she was the same classification as the plaintiffs. The district court properly found when it issued its decision denying the defendant's motions for summary judgment that basically she was a similarly situated individual to the plaintiffs, and that by
virtue... But that was just a mistake. She was never actually listed as a produce clerk.
And that was part of the discrimination.
They claimed time from her. I don't understand. Because she wasn't listed.
Well, that was part of the discrimination. That she was hidden by not being disclosed as a produce clerk.
I don't understand. So these guys are working. They want to have, supposing they apparently didn't want to have more time. But if they wanted more time, they'd look at the list of produce clerks junior to them, and they wouldn't see Villanueva's name. So how would her occasional presence in the produce department give them problems?
It's not the question of her presence in the produce department. It's the classification of her position, which there was no dispute that she was always or had been during the relevant time period classified as a produce
clerk.
That
was a mistake. Suppose I was classified as a produce clerk in Dominick's, but I never went there. It was just a mistake. I never heard of Dominick's. Would you still be claiming damages because of their mistake?
Well, Your Honor, the question of mistake is an issue.
My question. Suppose I am. They make a terrible mistake in Dominick's, and they say Richard Posner, we're promoting him from, you know, federal judge to produce clerk, and so that's fine. That's how it's listed in their books, but they never tell me. I never go there, and they don't tell the other produce clerks. So how in that situation could my misclassification cause damages to your clients?
Your misclassification could cause damage because of the fact that by virtue of your being in that position, you are then subject to having your hours taken away from you, and
they could grab
them.
But it's just a mistake. I don't have any hours. I don't work there. I've never been there. It makes it seem as if your client's looking for a windfall, that because they made some dumb mistake classifying her as a produce clerk, somehow that gives your clients damages. I mean, I understand with Epperstein, but I don't understand with Villanueva.
Well, Your Honors, they never remedied the problem. They knew of it.
What's the problem? They made a stupid mistake. What's the consequence of the mistake?
The consequence of the mistake is that they were deprived of hours that they should have had before
she did. But if they hadn't made the mistake, she wouldn't have had any hours, right?
She would have had hours in a different classification.
Right, and it wouldn't have affected your clients.
Correct.
You're just trying to exploit a mistake they made.
But there was an allocation of hours that they gave her from
that
position.
But that didn't affect anybody because she wasn't there.
But she was classified that way. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Utreris. Ms. Kage?
May it please the Court, Counsel. I'm Sarah Kagey on behalf of the defendant's appellees, Dominic's Finer Foods, Inc., the store managers, Mark Selby and Thomas Odette, and the produce manager, Robert Smith. The bottom line in this case is the plaintiffs had no damages. They have no proof of damages. They didn't a year ago. They don't now. And it follows that there are no damages, and thus there's no adverse action. The district court should be affirmed in its judgment that defendants were entitled to judgment because plaintiffs had failed to show that adverse action. The Seventh Circuit law is clear and controlling on this point. There must be a material adverse action in order to pursue claims under Title VII or Section 1981. And to be adverse, those actions...
Why has this case been going on for 6 years?
There was a long period of discovery, and there have been a number of delays up through summary judgment, and then there was a year.
Did you move for summary judgment on liability as opposed to damages?
We moved for summary judgment on liability. We made the argument at summary judgment that plaintiffs had no material adverse action.
Did you just argue no material adverse action or no discrimination?
We argued that there was no evidence of discrimination at the summary judgment.
When was that motion filed?
July 24, 2006.
What did the judge do? What did Judge Lefkoe do with that?
The district court denied our motion in some respects. There was mention of a Hispanic male, and his claims were dismissed at the summary judgment level. The district court said there might be a material adverse action because taking the facts in the light most favorable.
What did she say about discrimination?
She said that the Dominic's defendants should have noticed that Ms. Villanueva was misclassified and that Ms. Eppenstein was being accidentally listed at the bottom of the schedule, and that failure to notice.
What does that have to do with discrimination?
The district court, our position certainly is that the district court erred in denying summary judgment. The district court's opinion stated that because the two, Villanueva and Eppenstein, are white and the plaintiffs are African American, that Dominic's failure to notice this and Mr. Smith, the produce manager's, writing out of the schedules every week was sufficient evidence to get them past the summary judgment hurdle.
But as part of your summary judgment motion, hadn't you presented his affidavit or something in which you said it was a mistake?
Yes, we had presented.
Had they rebutted that?
No, that was not rebutted. Certainly, it is the Dominic's defendant's position that the district court did err in denying summary judgment, but that it ultimately came to the right conclusion in granting judgment to defendants on the eve of trial when presented with, once again, the fact that there were no damages, no material adverse action. That's what the ultimate grant of judgment to the defendants was based on.
Why did Robert Smith fill out the paperwork for Villanueva to transfer to the produce department after she expressed an interest in it? And under the collective bargaining agreement, was he required to first post that position?
There should have been, under the collective bargaining agreement, there should have been a posting for an open produce clerk position. And the record is conflicting as to whether there was such a posting. And to your point, that was the other point that the district court mentioned, is that there should have been a posting for this position. It's unclear. Mr. Smith testified he thought there had been a posting, that she expressed interest in it. He filled out the paperwork to transfer her. The next morning she came in and said, you know, I've thought about it. I'm not interested in transferring after all. And he didn't think about the paperwork again. It was left in a shared office. No one thought of it again. It apparently was sent to Dominic's Processing Center in Phoenix, where it entered her as a technically misclassified her as a produce clerk, although she showed up as a salad bar clerk on all the schedules, and she showed up and she worked only as a salad bar clerk. I see that my time is...
But can I just ask... I forgot my question. Sorry.
Well, let me go back.
Maybe Judge Kaney is...
This Judge Lefkoe's ruling came down when on this...
Which ruling? The final judgment that she entered in Dominic's favor was entered on March 3, 2008.
About the there was a preliminary one, though?
There was a summary judgment ruling in March of 2007. March 29, 2007, the district court denied summary judgment. Then the parties prepared for trial on March 3, 2008.
How long had that summary judgment motion been pending?
It was filed on July 24, 2006 and ruled on March 29, 2007.
That was the time when Judge Lefkoe was having some personal problems?
Actually, Judge Lefkoe had returned to the court by the time the summary judgment ruling, by the time the summary judgment motion was filed.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Kage. Mr. Carmel? Mr.
Good morning. May it please the court, Jonathan Carmel on behalf of the defendant, Local 881 UFCW, Patrick Statter. Your Honors, there's really not a hair's difference in our position on the damage issue with Dominic's. And I think those issues were addressed by you, Judge Posner. But again, proof of damages, competent or otherwise, assumes that there has to be a contract breach. And from the union's point of view and Mr. Statter's point of view as the union representative who was investigating the claim, there was simply no breach of the collective bargaining agreement. It was a mistake. When it was brought to his attention, he immediately remedied that by contacting Dominic's, getting her reclassified to the extent that she was misclassified, and he investigated to determine whether or not she was in fact working in the produce department and taking any of the hours from the plaintiffs. And he determined, based on witnesses, including employees in the produce department, that Ms. Villanueva indeed did not work in the produce department. There were no hours to claim. There were no hours that she was taking that they could have based on seniority and the other factors that go to claiming hours. So he concluded, quite properly, that there was no breach, and by getting her reclassified and getting Dominic's to correct its clerical error, remedied the grievance. And as far as the union's concerned, that was it. There was no there were no hours that she was working in the produce department. As for Ms. Eppenstein, they never even filed a grievance claiming that she had never filed a grievance claiming that there was a breach of the collective bargaining agreement. So without any breach, competent evidence of damages or otherwise, there was no damages. The plaintiffs in this case got a windfall when the union did resolve, obtained some money for them. But it was a complete windfall, and it was money that came from other grievances as well.
Are the produce clerks basically part-time workers?
There are some full, everyone's, there are a lot more part-timers today than there were years ago, but there are probably more part-timers on the schedules in the stores.
I'm curious about what is the thinking in having part-time produce clerks? Is it that you have surges of business at different times of day, or Dominic's?
I think, Your Honor, in the retail industry, the companies will argue that it gives them more flexibility in their scheduling by being able to move, mix and match employees and not committing blocks of time.
Are there any benefit differences?
There are under some collective bargaining agreements, Your Honors, that depending on how many hours depending on the collective bargaining agreement, you may not have enough hours to achieve certain benefits such as health insurance. But that's it. But, you know, it's more and more part-time workers and, you know.
Is there anything in the record about the average number of hours that the plaintiffs put in during this period?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. I mean, this was all along. And I would just note that this $87,000 is the first time I've heard this figure. That was never, as far as I can recall, ever presented to anybody. If you have no other questions.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So, Mr. Utreris, your time has expired, but you can have another minute if you have something you'd like to.
Thank you, Your Honors. Your Honors, as the rules of civil procedure indicate, after the ruling on summary judgment, the case was to be proceeding to trial. There's nothing within the rules that would allow the court to revisit this question.
Well, there's nothing that can prevent the judge. No. There's no rule which says, yes, keep going back to original to issues you just said. No, the judge can always reexamine a question basis. When you get to trial, the judge has to worry, you know, are the parties going to present a case that the jury can understand? And if not, no trial.
Well, Your Honor, this is
the way it's described in the briefs, you were just kind of fling at the jury some huge mass of, you know, pay records and so on, and let them somehow figure out some damage numbers.
Is this the very first time that anyone has heard the number 87,000?
Well, Your Honor, consistent with this court's requirements that the parties meet and confer, we went back to the table and revisited this question, and so it's not part of the underlying district court record, and that's where we came up with that formula and that amount. But again, my point was that just factual questions, I believe, should have been allowed to be played out before the jury on this.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Utreris and Ms. Pegge, Mr. Carmel. Our next case.